want to welcome everybody here this morning and thank you all for being here today. At our first meeting of this Health and Human Services Committee in the House in the 73rd Legislative Assembly, so I want to welcome each and every one of these members who are here today. And looks like Representative Butler will be joining us a little late. He has another commitment right now, but he'll be down soon. So it's exciting. Most people are returning, except for Debbie Boone, who's our newest member, so welcome.
Thank you.
And what that means is we have a pretty experienced committee here, so I'm pretty excited about that, especially with the leadership of our vice chairs, both of whom have been here for several sessions and have a deep base of knowledge in the process. And so I'm looking to Representative Tomei and Representative Jensen to assist us in having a good session here. So welcome to all the members. I think the first thing we should do is consider the committee rules, and then we'll proceed on with the agenda. But have you had a chance to look at the committee rules? They're pretty much standard for all the House committees. And so I'd like to move those rules unless there are any objections. So,
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the committee rules.
Representative Tomei moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated January 17, 2005. Is there any discussion? Without objection, the committee rules are adopted. Committee, I was talking with our staff about our work plan for this session. Excuse me. And one of the things that came up was I had an interest in seeing the committee being able to take up some business, not just here in the building, but outside the building, so that people would have an opportunity to participate who might not otherwise be able to come down to the Capitol. And so what I thought we could do is take our show on the road on a couple of dates, or also to hold committee meetings in the evening occasionally, so that people might be able to participate in the evening after work hours, so that they're not not caught up with other obligations that they can't participate in this committee process. So I just wanted to gauge the interest of the committee to doing something like that. I guess what I had envisioned was having a special meeting, we'll call it special meeting for now, once a month. And so once a month we'd have a meeting in the evening, once a month we'd have a meeting on a Saturday, and it could rotate for the 5 months or so that we'll be doing work in this committee. And so, but the one question came up, did we want to have that additional meeting in lieu of one of our meetings, our regularly scheduled meetings, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, or did we want to have that meeting in addition to our meetings? And I suspect that during the week, if we're going to do an evening meeting, then we'll have it in lieu of that week's meeting. But do you have any thoughts on an additional meeting for Saturday? On certain occasions, it'd probably be three Saturdays. Anybody have any objections to that? Representative Anderson, you'd like to go home?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do try to get home as often as I can. Sure. Saturdays, 3 hours away, are a little more difficult than for, I suppose, some of you. And I think Representative Jensen just indicated his extreme pleasure in the idea of staying. But I would be open to staying for Saturday, maybe here and there, but I'd really rather focus on the evenings. That's a great idea.
Evening. Okay, great. Well, maybe our first meeting could be down there in Grants Pass, followed by Pendleton. So, okay. Well, I just wanted to gauge.
So moved.
Great. I wanted to gauge the interest on that this morning. And so today we are going to have an informational meeting on the Department of Human Services. I've been traveling for some time before the session started, and I would check in for my daily dose of Oregon news because I'm a junkie that way. And I started to read about some of the real tragedies that were occurring with children in the state that were under the protection of the Child Protective Services. And it's just a really significant problem, I think, an alarming problem and an immediate problem. And we had some discussions with some of our colleagues about this, and I wanted to get to the bottom of what was happening within the Child Protective Services Agency, see if there were structural things that we could take up and guidance we could give to the agency to make sure that children children in this state are protected. And so to that end, I invited the Department of Human Services to come in and give a presentation about their system overall, the new critical incident response team process, and what's going on to ensure that children are protected in the future. So I'd ask the Department of Human Services to come forward, Mr. Ramona Foley, Ms. Una Swanson, and Mr. Kevin George with the department. So good morning, welcome.
Thank you.
So it sounds like you're going to start with the critical incident review response team process.
Yes, Chair Dalto, with permission, we would like to reverse that on the agenda.
Sure.
And start with a discussion around the CERT.
Before you begin, I just wanted to say one other thing. You know, we noticed a small problem on our agenda. When I got the agenda back, I noticed that there was not an opportunity for public testimony or public comment on the agenda. And so my first instinct as I saw that was to ask staff to add that to the agenda. But we ran into the 48-hour rule in which we did not have enough time to actually change the agenda to post public testimony. So an example of how that rule could be inflexible, I guess. But what we'll do is if there's anybody in the audience that wanted to offer public testimony, the chair can invite you to come up. And so I would invite you to express interest to our staff. We'll have a sheet over there to let us know if you want to come up, and then we'll invite you to come up and testify later. So having said that, you may proceed.
Thank you, Representative Dalto, Chair Dalto. For the record, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm an assistant director at the Department of Human Services over an area called Children, Adults, and Families. And I have with me today Kevin George to my left, and Kevin is our manager of our foster care program. And to my right is Una Swanson, and she's manager of Child Protective Services. We thank you for this opportunity to meet with the committee today. We do have a new process in place called a critical incident response team process. And so this is our first opportunity to come and present this process and have some feedback from you all, because we think this is a pretty critical process that we're going, that we have embarked on. There are three documents we have supplied for the committee today. And one of those is a beige-colored book called The Status of Children Report 2003. And this data is the data that we will be speaking about today, but this will be updated for our Ways and Means presentation, and we'll be using 2004 data. We expect that publication to come out in early April. The other document you have is you have a copy of the Child Welfare Protocol that we'll be referencing today. And this is the overall protocol that we put in place when we have a situation of a child fatality, for example, due to abuse and neglect. And then you also have something that's entitled a 30-day CERT review report. And this is actually the first 30-day report of a case that has been through the critical incident response team process. So with those documents before you, and with permission, what we'd like to do, as I said, is start talking a little bit about critical incident response team, and then we will broaden that with some of the things that we are seeing across even just two cases that we have looked at, and some of the things our national experts are telling us we need to take on here in Oregon. First, let me say that it may go without saying, but I feel the need to say that any time we are discussing a child's death or a serious injury due to abuse and neglect, that this is a tragedy in our society. It's a tragedy whether it's in Oregon or any other state. And that is one of the things that brings us to the need to have a critical incident response team, is we do have these tragedies occur in our system. I think a greater tragedy, though, is when we are able to not look at such an incident to see what is it we can learn from this. There are lessons in almost every case that we pick up. And when we have a situation where all things come together and do not result in a good outcome for children, it certainly behooves us to take the time to look at that with you all, and help us look at our system and how we can make improvements to try to preclude these kinds of things from happening in the system. The second thing I want to say, just as an overall comment, is the primary providers of safety for children are their parents and their relatives. And all of us generally operate from that perspective. Many of you who have families know that the kinds of issues that happen with children can be very stressful, depending on the age of your children, but at the same time, you recognize a responsibility you have as a parent, and that extended family shares that responsibility. So our laws and our approaches and how we work with families really is based on the fact that we want to respect a family's right to protect their children. But government has a role whenever that can't be accomplished, and government's role, of course, then is to be involved if there's an issue around parents not providing safely for their children. But I think it's an important concept because things, the work that's done in prevention, the work that we do through Commission on Children and Families in the state, those are things that help families before they become known to Child Protective Services. And then third, an overall observation that I have is the strategies we've been using in our state to work with families. We have some wonderful strategies, and some of these we've had national accolades about the strategies that really originated in Oregon. What I think we are going to be posing to you today, though, is the families we are working with, some of the complexity around these families, and an example of that, as you all know, are families who are involved with methamphetamine. Some of the strategies may not be the best ways of approaching those particular families, and yet we do have strategies that we are applying to very complex problems, and that's something we would appreciate any help from you all as we look at how are the families different now than they were 10 years ago in this state, and what is it we can do to make sure that the strategies that we're using, and that's one of the reasons we have the national experts coming in, what are the strategies that would be more current for working with some of these very difficult cases?
Monica, I pause you there.
Sure.
You said for us to pay attention to how families are different now than they were 10 years ago. Could you elaborate on that point? Could you share with us what you know about how these families are changing?
Specifically, we know that the major stressors of families for Child Protective Services this past year, for 2003, the year that we have the data, were stressors such as alcohol and drug abuse, stressors such as unemployment, which of course is a major issue with the families we're trying to serve right now in our state, domestic violence. And the fourth stressor is our families have, many of them have extensive criminal backgrounds. And the methamphetamine problem alone on the West Coast is really driving our system in a way that I don't think any of us, I certainly wouldn't have anticipated. I wasn't on the West Coast 10 years ago. But I think the kinds of approaches we have that are very well-intentioned approaches are really being challenged now with the families that we're talking about. And as we talk about generally child welfare, we actually have percentages of how, what percentage of the families we're talking about have those particular four problems. But I think those are really challenging our staff at this point. And I think as this problem is identified around the country, I know over the holidays there was an article about the meth problem now surfacing in Pennsylvania. One of the hopes is that as the problem has become more widespread, there'll be more attention given to research and evidence-based practice around how to work with families where methamphetamine is a prevailing issue. I hope that answers your question, Representative Dalton.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Like most states, first of all, I'll talk a little bit about why we decided to develop a process called Critical Incident Response Team. Like most states, we have in place already child fatality reviews. And the child fatality review is an opportunity for the Department of Human Services to come together with MDTs. Those are multidisciplinary teams. And by law, every county has a multidisciplinary team. And those teams do look at any case where there's a child fatality of when it's due to abuse and neglect. This is going to continue. That role of the multidisciplinary team and the role of the child fatality review will continue. We don't want to interrupt that, but one of the observations was that review sometimes is not timely. That review can take several months. Sometimes it can be a year until the report comes back out in terms of the actual details around a child fatality. It also, that review doesn't necessarily equate to specific steps that human services or child welfare needs to take in order to make sure we're reducing the likelihood that a case similar to that won't reoccur. And so, around this goal of timeliness and the goal of accountability, Governor Kulongoski did direct us last summer to develop and implement a response team, a response system, that would begin to achieve what our traditional fatality review process had not been able to do, and that is very timely tell us what did we see in a particular case and what steps should the system be taking or DHS be taking in order to address those problems. The governor appointed a task force, and the task force included law enforcement, included court representation, the court-appointed special advocates, the CASA program, Juvenile Rights Project, and others. And that task force came together and worked over a three-month period of time. And at the end of that, the task force assisted the Department of Human Services in developing the product that you have before you called the protocol. In November, the governor did announce that we would be implementing this particular protocol when it became necessary to implement it. And, of course, we all hoped that we would never have to implement it, because that's what any of us would hope about the safety of children in our system. This process is a new process in Oregon. It's also a new process from a national perspective. As I said, most states have something that resembles a child fatality review, but states have really struggled with how to come forward and actually say, here is what we saw that did not work well in a particular case. And that is difficult for states because of a number of reasons, not all related to just law, but just in terms of being able to be that insightful, being able to say, here are some things that we're going to have to really stress changes in our practice. Yes, Chair.
I wonder if you could draw a contrast between this new critical incidence response team process and what we had in place previously.
Previously, we had probably a good example of a case that I will share with you because it has been in the public's domain. There was a case of a child named Tucker Sherman. And Tucker Sherman was a little boy in the Dalles. And Tucker Sherman was, it was an in-home service case. Tucker Sherman was killed by his mother's partner, her friend, I guess. That would be the description, I would say, her partner. And that case happened about 3.5 years ago. And when there was a conviction, when the case went to trial and there was a conviction of this gentleman, the newspaper carried a very excellent but very graphic article about this particular case. And I think as people looked at that case, what we didn't really have was any public accounting of what difference this case made in our system. We all knew the child had died. We also knew internally we had had a child fatality review committee and that we had made some changes in our own policy, one of the changes being that when you are investigating or assessing a child protective services case, one of the individuals that you need to be consulting with is the non-custodial parent, not just the custodial parent. But we didn't really have a public record that we could go to. So by memory, we were saying to the press, here are some of the things that changed after this particular child's death. But what was missing and what will not be missing with a critical incident response is that there is a public record that lists, here are the things that are going to have to be changed, here's how those things are going to be changed, here's who's going to do what, and here's the time frame. So our hope is it really does bring a public accountability around a child's case so that by oral history we're not trying to recall, we had a terrible case 3 years ago, what did we ever do to try to address those kinds of cases in our system? So I think that is the most significant difference in how we have handled cases in the past. The protocol you see is not in statute and it's not in rule at this point, and that was a deliberate decision because, as I said, we are testing something that is new, new to us and new around the country. And we really want to see how this process works. Does it get us where we want to get in terms of the accountability and in terms of the timeliness of our agency responding to these situations? And we've asked our statewide, we have a statewide statutory advisory committee, Child Welfare Advisory Committee, we've asked them to be involved in helping us evaluate quarterly how the process is working. What are the things that they're seeing that they think are responsive? Are there some tweaks? Are there some differences that they would suggest? And we offer that same to you all as a committee. What are the things about the process you think may still be shortcomings?
Excuse me, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Foley, I'm looking at your protocol. First of all, I should acknowledge you first for the great job that I see that you've done and for the working any of our colleagues who have ever any concern about these kinds of issues, Ms. Foley is extremely approachable, as are members of her staff, and I appreciate that. But as I look at the protocol, I have a question. Well, first of all, a correction to the definitions under the protocol. You show critical incident under ORS 419A.0425. It's really 24. 25 deals with some other definitions, but 24 deals with the fatality or serious injury. Well, let's see, 25 actually deals with shelter care, meaning a home or a facility. 24 really gets to the issue of a physical injury. But and then it refers over to Oregon Revised Statutes 161.015, where physical injury or serious physical injury is discussed. And I wondered at that point, and I appreciate your sensitivity to the fatalities. I guess in some of these instances, when these terrible things end in a fatality, that probably is preferable to some of the treatment some of these youngsters are subjected to over long periods of time, and that's a terrible thing to have to say, but that sometimes is realistically what happens. The serious injury I've got question about, though, is why you've used the serious physical injury as opposed to physical injury for your definitions. Physical injury means an impairment of physical condition or substantial pain. Serious physical injury, and now I'm coming back to 024, parentheses 24, has a permanent or protracted significant effect on a child's daily activities, results in substantial or recurring pain. In the case of a child under 10 years of age, a bone is broken. And that's serious physical injury, whereas physical injury means the impairment or physical condition or substantial pain. I assume that's just recurring. That's a spanking, isn't it?
Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, one of the distinctions we were trying to make there, and first of all, let me thank you for finding that particular site. I must say that there have been dozens and dozens of sets of eyes that have proofed and proofed and reproofed this, but this is the first time, and I should have known it would be Representative Butler who might find that, that we really appreciate that. The distinction we were trying to make is every day our staff are assessing issues related to physical abuse, and so the distinction is for a case to actually rise to the level of a critical incident response team, we have to make some distinction because we don't want to do those investigations out of central office. We do want to look at those that we believe from the committee's perspective meet a certain level of abuse. And one of those cases that we will talk about today a little bit is the young woman, the five-year-old in foster care, that we felt that level of abuse certainly rose to the level of this kind of response team where we need to look to see what our actions were in that case.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So in this case, you've selected, and I think wisely so, the serious physical injury, but I just wanted to make certain, because it does refer back to the statute in 419A, for a child under 10 years of age, where a bone is broken, is that the serious that rises to the level where the critical incident response team is involved?
I will, Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, I will call on Una Swanson to say specifically what we envision in terms of this distinction, as she's the Child Protection Director.
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, thank you. For the record, I'm Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Manager for Children, Adults, and Families. And I appreciate your comments, Representative Butler. The kinds of critical events that we were focusing on for the critical incident response team are those incidents that create serious physical harm to children, and I appreciate your highlighting the age perspective, I think for a critical incident response team response, we would not limit that to just children under the age of 10. Certainly, if we had an event that involved a child over age 10 with serious injury as described, we would want to evaluate that for a critical incident response team approach as
thank,
well.
Thank you very much. That's responsive to my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. In addition to the timeliness and accountability that the team is supposed to be addressing, we wanted to make sure that as the team approaches any case, that there are five things that that team is going to come back and give advice on, or the recommendations on. One is, is there any needed change for a statute or for some administrative rule? Are we operating under something that in some ways is not adding to the safety of children? The second is the policies and procedures that our staff are operating under. Do we have a problem in our policy or our procedure? Is that something we need to be looking at to rewrite? Is it a practice? There is variation. As you all know, we have a central office where our policies and procedures are developed, and then in 46 counties around the state, we have, 36 counties around the state. I just added 10 more. Maybe that was Idaho. I'm sorry. We have the counties who actually develop some procedures on their own as to how they accommodate the policies and procedures coming from central office. And that's important because we have to examine those practices from one county to the other to see if that is something that contributes to a particular outcome in a case. Training is another issue. And training goes side by side with things like a change in the law or a change in a policy or procedure. We can't do those changes effectively without doing training of our staff around the field. And then the other is the personnel issue. Human resources is also part of the team, and human resources is able to do sort of on a separate plane an investigation to balance how well staff or individuals performed in a particular case and to put that up against how well the system itself performed. We have to make sure that staff have the right tools and the right skills to do their jobs every day. So, in fact, you can have a staff member who does perform or who doesn't perform that particular job, but we always have to be looking to see, did we equip that individual to do the job well? And that is one of the reasons we have the human resources group also involved in these investigations or these assessments. Briefly, in terms of how that CERT, the Critical Incident Response Team, works, there is something in our rule called a sensitive issue, and staff are very used to sending us notice the day they know that there is a sensitive issue. And a sensitive issue can be something such as a child fatality, but it can also be any event that rises to the level that they believe central office needs to be involved. Chair Dalto.
So who's receiving the notices of sensitive issues?
Those notices come, Chair Dalto, those notices come to a set of individuals in central office, including the director, Gary Weeks, including myself, including Una, Kevin, and a handful of other people who have to assess whether or not what's coming in needs immediate action or does it rise to the level that it's a critical incident response.
And so what does your sort of flow of sensitive issue notices look like? I mean, are you getting quite a few?
We always, Chair Dalto, we always have had, I believe, and I'll ask Una to correct me if this isn't true, when we went through this process, we tried to go back and see how many we receive over the year, and I think it was in the neighborhood of 100 sensitive issues. We receive quite a few, most of which will never rise to the level of interest beyond the fact that the county is working on something. I'll give you an example of one. The county may be working on a case, and the individual, the grandparent in that case, says, well, I've decided to go and talk to the press about my situation. I'm not happy with what's happening to my case. And that's fine. And what the local office wants to do is just alert us that if we get a phone call that the local office does have this particular issue and is working on something with the family. So that in itself could be a sensitive issue but would not generate a critical incident response.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we, from the sensitive issues, a CERT process is activated at the direction of Gary Weeks, the director of the agency. And often one of us will see that issue come through, and we will know that this actually does constitute a critical incident in need of a response, and we will recommend to Director Weeks. But he makes that decision. And like I said, the CERT is designed to address the critical incident, and examples of that are things like a serious injury to a child or a child death when we suspect that abuse or neglect may be involved in the death of that child.
Excuse me. Are you able to get some indication in a proactive way before an event occurs with your CERT process? Or is there some, you know, is there some other mechanism to alert you, you know, prior to an event?
Chair Dalto, we may get alerted to an event by the media. We may get alerted to an event by law enforcement. But there is something that will trigger that case to a sensitive issue, if that's what you're asking.
I guess what I'm asking is how we know, how the agency knows ahead of time when there is a situation where the circumstances may have changed in the household, or the problems are occurring in the household to the level of the agency as opposed to in the local field office?
Chair Dalto, most of those cases would be known at the local level. However, we are able in central office sometimes to, as we read that sensitive issue, it may raise certain questions for us that do then raise the profile of that case so that we are actually staffing that case with the local office. So we are always looking for that kind of information. We also have another process in place called a Child and Family Services Review, where we go county by county and do a review where we pull cases, our quality assurance group pulls cases and reads cases to look for the kinds of things that might be issues that could lead to a critical incident in a particular family. So that's the kind of work that we do routinely with our staff in the field. But the distinction here is something has now happened, and regardless of how it got to us, Director Weeks believes we need to have this level of review attached to it.
So is there some way for the central agency to be able to regularly look in on the local field offices and get these sort of reports or sort of oversee? How does it work, the process of which the state office would oversee the local offices?
Well, Chair Dalto, as I said, we have a regular review, and that review will be done in a county, I think on the average of every 2 years right now. And we go in and pull a sample of cases, and we review those cases, and we look to see what the compliance is with the law, with federal and state law. We're also looking to see the compliance with policies and procedures. And then we're looking for issues that might just trigger that this could be a high-profile case, or this could be a case that would come to us at some point because there is an issue of safety related to a child in this home. And those we get immediately back to the county, and the county begins working on adjusting whatever the safety plan is. The other thing to keep in mind, too, is the child welfare system is fairly complex but does have quite a bit of oversight, and that is by design, and that's a good thing. And that oversight is in the form of the juvenile court, who looks at, the court will look at cases of children who have come into care, who have been removed from their families. We also have the court-appointed special advocates program. We don't have, those are CASAs, we don't have those in every case in the state, but for children in foster care, a large percentage of our cases have CASAs, and they are supposed to be the eyes and ears of the child. We also have legal representation for children in the foster care system. In the child protective system, we consistently try to monitor through that child and family services review to see exactly how they're handling assessments, how they're handling phone calls that come in alleging abuse and neglect. So we do have, and they do work for us. At the end of the day, I mean, that's the bottom line. The managers in the field in the child welfare area do answer to the central office in terms of their own accountability.
Representative Greenlink.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here today. I'll see if I can formulate my question in a way that makes some sense. In reviewing the 30-day CERT review report, I see a lot of places where there are statements like, there were frequent visits made, but the records were not adequately kept, and those sort of things. And I come out of the healthcare field, so I know some quality review stuff is a CYA activity, and some is really meant to improve the system. But what troubles me here is the extent to which there's systemic, a systemic view when you take, I mean, who in the agency is looking at, will be looking at the certs and saying, well, we don't have enough staff. I mean, yeah, we can beat on the staff to see the patients, to see the our foster kids more often, or we can beat on them to get the records right, or we can beat on them to do something else. And I just keep wondering, in times of budget shortages we have now, the extent to which there's a critical review that says to us, we're 400 staff members short, and as long as we have 400 staff members short, then we're going to have this problem, or we're going to have this problem, and we can solve some of it, but we can't solve all of it. So we'll have just as many CRTs, but we'll have a different explanation for the problem in the next set of CRTs. I mean, is there some way to get above the individual case?
Chair Dalto and Representative Greenlick, that is an excellent question, and that's actually what our intent is. And as we go through discussing this process a little bit, one of the things we have really tried to avoid, because we are very, very aware of what the budget situation is, and we're aware of stress that this can bring to staff. However, we have sought through this process to not try to give ourselves ready excuses for good practice and good work. And what it may mean is that we may be sharing with you all some ideas of kind of re-engineering the work that we're doing in child welfare. And I think we have to be very open to hearing ideas and looking at that, because it is not a situation where if we added 400 more staff today, if what the work is that staff are doing does not provide for safety of children, then it won't matter how many staff we add. And that's what we're really having to get down to as we do this CERT process, and that's one of the uses of that national expert, is helping us to look, how have we grown the child welfare practice in our state, and is that practice really getting at what you all in the public believe we should be getting at around safety of children? It's a very tough question, but I hope that you're going to be able to hear us talk a little bit about some of the general things we're seeing. Well, I don't believe we have to go case by case across 30,000 cases in the state to find what we think some of the patterns are that are emerging.
Mr. Chairman, I have a brief follow-up. I wonder the extent to which you're also talking about adding technology. I suppose my view of child protective services comes out of watching Time Daily, being a child protective worker, and I see these piles of charts, which also looks like what you'd find in any medical office nowadays, or most medical offices, pile of charts. There certainly are ways to provide tools that make charting much easier. Are we on our way to doing some of that?
I guess Vice Chair Jensen and Representative Greenlick, we are, and we're pretty far behind in child welfare as a profession. Technology has come last probably to child welfare of all the human services. And that, if you trace back to see where the federal requirements are and where they have evolved, technology has arisen in child welfare over the last 5 to 7 years, so it's fairly new. We are attempting, and as we go to Ways and Means, you will see us bringing forth a policy package that does help us move towards more technology to be able to do what most of us would consider very simple assumptions about how we do record keeping. One of the things we'll talk about in just a little bit that we have found in these cases, in one case, and I don't want to take away from Kevin and Uma's description of this, but in one case, the case wasn't very well filed in terms of how things were there and what was there in terms of documentation. In the other case, which I personally looked at, the volumes, I was sitting at a table with 6 volumes, about 4 inches thick each, and I'm sitting there and thinking, if I were a young worker, a young caseworker, how would I possibly know where to start with these volumes? Would I know to go to volume 1 and try to dig back to see what was the original issue with this family? And whenever our national expert looked at our volumes of paper, he made the comment, he said, you know, there's going to be some recommendations from us in that we see some fairly archaic practices here in terms of how we are keeping those records, how we retain every piece of paper that we've ever come in contact with. And the paper file then, of course, is in addition to our automated system. So if you generate what's in the automated system, that creates more paper. But that is an issue that we're seeing across the files that we've looked at just so far.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Thank you again for coming, folks, today. I'm following up on Representative Greenlich's questions. And maybe you don't have this information today, but if you could get us information about how many cases a typical caseworker has, how many in protective services, how many in foster care, et cetera, that would be very helpful to us to know what kind of a caseload the caseworkers are carrying these days. Also, I would like to know the education that some of these folks have that will be looking at some of these sensitive issues.
Okay, Vice Chair Jensen and Representative Domain, we'd be glad to get that. In addition, we will give you, we will try to give you numbers in terms of case-carrying staff, but also in terms of non-case-carrying staff. Because the more staff we have that are non-case carrying, of course, the larger the caseload becomes for those who are carrying the cases. And that's one of the issues that I think we have to look at as we look across our system to see increasing caseloads. Are there other resources that we have that somehow could be converted? And we would have a lower caseload than by converting some of the non-case carrying staff. So we will get both of those sets of figures for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ramona, again, I appreciate all the good work that you do, and I think it'd probably be remiss if I didn't also acknowledge your assistant, Mickey Cerise. He's been very, very helpful and a great contact for me as a legislator in my district. But as I go through, excuse me, the protocol, there's a lot of agency speak here, and I don't understand most of it. And if some of these are going to start sounding like ways and means questions, you'll just have to forgive me. But I would like to know. And on the third page of the protocol, it talks about right at the top of that page under subpart 3, dealing with the notification process. It says a 307 must be created if a critical incident involves a child fatality or a safety threat to a child. And I'm assuming that again, the safety threat to the child goes back to 419A. 0.024, where it talks about the physical injury has a permanent or protracted significant effect on a child's daily activities, results in substantial reoccurring pain, or in the case of a child under 10 years of age where a bone is broken, and Una has indicated that would even go beyond that definition there. But I'm assuming that a 307 must be agency speak for a standard form for child abuse. Is that what that is?
Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, that is what that is. It actually is the form, and an example would be if we have a child fatality, then someone at the local level will be assessing whether or not other children in that family are at risk. Okay. So if it's not an open case, it may become an open case that day in terms of completing a 307 and doing the work that needs to be done for the CPS or the Child Protective Service Assessment.
Representative Butler, could I just pause this for a moment to welcome Representative Minnis, Karen Minnis, Speaker of the House, to this panel, who has a great interest in this issue and what we're seeing with the Department of Human Services is doing on child welfare. Follow-up, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the indication that late on IT information technology has been introduced into the process, and I appreciate Representative Greenlich and Representative Tomei's questions relative to that, but I would like to know that on a daily basis you know exactly how many employees you have that are overseeing all of these kinds of matters. You know on a daily basis exactly how many youngsters are involved in the system and exactly where they're at, do you not?
Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, we do know that.
Okay. And then with regard to the, I appreciate that we're talking about CERT reevaluation process and the review of CERT itself, but how often is a case reviewed of the, how many daily cases do you have right now on the books?
Thank you. Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, on any particular day, we will have approximately 15,000 cases, including cases that are under investigation or are in-home service cases, and we have approximately 7,000, a little over 7,000 children who are in the foster care system on any particular day.
And that, Mr. Chair, follow-up clarification. The 15,000 includes the 7,000 children in the care system?
Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, that does not include. And Una, would you say that 15,000 would cover in-home services or approximately 9,000 cases? And then at any point, I think we would say there are 6,000 children who are subject to some type of an assessment or a review that's happening at the local level. And then the 7,000 in foster care, 7,400 or so, are in addition to those in-home child protective service cases.
Okay, and so my question, Mr. Chair, is to the director, relative to those that are not subject to the CERT review, how often do you receive of those that are in-home or in foster care, not the 6,000 that are up for assessment, but how often are your files updated on that portion of the 22,000 cases?
Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, those files have the capacity to be updated on a daily basis. We have certain requirements in both Child Protective Services and in foster care in terms of face-to-face contact, for example. On any open case, the caseworker is required to see the child, see the family, at least every 30 days. So that would in and of itself be an update, for example, to the system. But those cases are routinely being supervised locally by the supervisor or by the child welfare manager in the supervisor's absence, so that the workers have someone they are reporting to about how they're handling those cases. We then take that data and are able to produce actually what's getting to be better and better, not necessarily better in terms of what the data looks like, but more and more accurate reports to say to a county, you have X number of cases in the assessment process, you have X number who are almost due for the final decision on this process, and you have X number of days left. We're able to say to the counties how many cases they have that we can look in the system and say they have the face-to-face contact being conducted, how many that they may be conducting the face-to-face contact, but the data is not being put into the system, and therefore that's a management issue at the local level as to how to get that data in the system. So we do have the ability to make some kinds of assessments of how well the county is doing.
Representative Butler, if I could just jump in there for a moment. I wanted to ask the department a question about these face-to-face meetings in the home. To what extent does the child protective worker have an idea of what they're going to encounter on the other end of, on the other side of the door when they arrive? I mean, they may of course have some kind of information about the guardian or parent and the child itself, but when you have a situation when there are non-custodial parents or other people that are present at the home, as you described in the case with Tucker Sherman and undoubtedly other cases, to what extent are the child protective workers knowledgeable about what's happening or who those people are in that household, and to what extent does law enforcement participate in assisting child welfare to know who the folks are?
Chair Dalto, usually the place that workers will say they know the least might be when they are making the initial contact on a child protective service assessment. And that's why often the child protective service worker who's going to go out on that case initially will go along with law enforcement. They can look into the database and they can determine whether or not this case already has a history with the department. In looking at that history, they may be able to tell that there is a drug issue or that there's a domestic violence issue. But the workers generally, once the case is opened, the worker will be going either with another worker or sometimes alone to that home. If the family is so unsafe that the worker can't go to that home, then that would really beg the question about whether or not children were left there to start with when we made that first initial contact. If it's that unsafe, generally law enforcement and child protection will go ahead and make a removal of the child. But one of the issues that we know that we need attention to is we have not routinely accessed law enforcement records of individuals or adults in a household. And this does present a danger not only to the children or the families in that household, it also presents a danger for our own staff. Now, law enforcement, we have worked through law enforcement from time to time to get access to try to see exactly who all is there and what kind of criminal histories are in that home. But this is one of the issues that Una and her staff have taken on to try to make sure that Child Protective Services is able to access law enforcement data to find out who the parents are, whether or not there is danger, whether or not we should be going to that home alone, or whether or not we should be going with law enforcement.
Why are we waiting to this late date to sort of have some kind of resolution for that access? I mean, surely this isn't a problem that's a recent problem.
Chair Dalto, in looking at it, I totally agree. It's not a new problem. What we have done is we have followed instructions from Congress. Congress said around 1997 that you must have criminal records done if you are going to be a foster parent or an adoptive parent. They did not speak to criminal records of birth parents or extended family. If relatives are going to care for their relative child and they want to be licensed or certified as foster family, they have to have criminal records. But Congress was silent on the issue of in-home services and families. And I actually believe what's happening is it's another case where the practice and the need for a change in practice is moving faster than what we have accessed technology for. Law enforcement records generally are available, and I don't want to speak as an expert on LETS because that's really not my area, but law enforcement records are available to law enforcement agencies. The Department of Human Services is not categorized as a law enforcement agency, and therefore we have not routinely been able to directly access. Now, there are exceptions to that. We do have more direct access, for example, in Multnomah County, because we have had our hotline where the abuse reports come in co-housed with law enforcement. And so there has been more access there. But another case, another tragedy in our system was the little girl named Cassandra Hodges in Klamath Falls, who was allegedly killed this past fall by her mother or her mother's partner. And I'm not sure, I don't remember all the details on that, but and I'm not sure the case has been to trial. But Ed Caleb, the DA down in Klamath Falls, came forth and said, you know, this is a really good example of a social service system not being able to access quickly law enforcement data to see whether or not we have safe caretakers in a home when we are initially involved with that family. We may not have any history with that family, but the family may have history with law enforcement. And so that was really an incentive to say, work with LEDS, see how much we can access these kinds of records to make sure that when we walk away from that home on the initial visit, we believe that child still is going to be safe in that family.
See, it seems to me, Representative Anderson, we have three people on the list. It seems to me that you said earlier, as these families are changing in the past decade, we're having more problems with drug and alcohol abuse, unemployment, domestic violence, and extensive criminal histories. But we're really, you're saying that we don't have the ability to get that criminal information in some kind of a systemic and timely way. And so if you're at the leading edge and you know that you're running into homes with you know, criminality issues and you know, dangerous people coming in and out, because it's not just the parent or the custodian for that child, but I mean, if you have drug and alcohol issues, you have all sorts of people coming in and out of the household. I mean, and you are having some struggles in getting access to this this law enforcement information, wouldn't it be appropriate that that we put the department in a position where they could have regular access? Or, I mean, it seems to me you're evolving this role of child protection into I don't want to say that you're responsible for law enforcement, but I mean you're so the nexus there is so clear between your protective services and law enforcement that you need to be more responsive, or you need the ability to be more responsive. So would it be appropriate that we grant you some kind of additional assistance in getting access to those records?
Chair Dalto, I'll call on Una to talk because she's been involved with that process. But while she's preparing for that, one of the things to keep in mind, too, is there's two different databases. One is law enforcement's database here in Oregon, and that's really what we're talking about at this point. But there's also the NCIC, which is the national database, and only law enforcement agencies have access to the national database. In the case of Cassandra Hodges, the man living in the home was actually known, would have been known through a national database if he were known at all. He would not have been known in the Oregon system. So Una can update you on where we are in terms of that access.
Chair Dalto, the Department of Human Services has been working with the LEDS administration through the fall to move access to the LEDS database into the individual child welfare offices, and as we speak, that process is taking place. As Ramona mentioned, Department of Human Services has in the past been able to run criminal records checks for the suitability determination of providers. This change would represent our ability to run criminal records checks on biological parents and other household members of families where children are living when we meet them at the Child Protective Services level. So we are moving forward to do that. The one issue that has come up most recently is that while it's clear that our current administrative rule and the statute would allow us as Department of Human Services to access that criminal records information on biological parents or household members, it does not currently allow us to do that without prior notification. Notification has, in the legal advice that we've received both from the LEDS attorney and from our representation, notification does not mean permission, but it does mean that we can't access that permission prior to having contact with that family and getting the identifying information. And that is where we're at now. That will certainly put us ahead of where we were. We will be able to gather information when we're in the home about everyone who's there and run those criminal records checks as we make ongoing safety plans, but it does prevent us from getting their criminal records information when we go out prior. And as the situation is now, we'll continue to work with law enforcement and collaborate with them whenever we can to gain that kind of information.
Madam Speaker.
Who generally has the authority to get a LEDS file? Is that done through administrative rule or under the law? Who currently has that? Is it police, sworn police officers, or does your agency have the ability under the law to go in and review those statutes?
Okay. Chair Dalto and Chair Minnis, I'm not sure I completely understand the question. Is who is the entity that can provide that access?
Who has the ability to look at that information? Who has the authority to go in and look at that? Can a caseworker? Any caseworker? Any law enforcement entity? What is the protocol?
Chair Dalto and Speaker Minnis, law enforcement, a police officer can actually do that. The only exception to that is the exception that was carved out after Congress enacted the law that says that foster parents and adoptive parents have to be able to be checked for criminal records prior to participating in the program. So we have a criminal records unit in our central office that's trained by law enforcement, and they're considered licensed, or in other words, they're able to do that kind of check, but just on the categories of foster parents and adoptive parents. They also do, I believe, some employee, they do the employee checks for us. They are not allowed under that rule to do the check of in-home service cases where we have parents or other adult members of the household. We do not have that authority. Only law enforcement carries that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Who supervises the people looking into those types of records?
Chair Dalto and Speaker Minnis, those records are in our administrative services branch. Georgina Caro is the actual administrator for that particular branch, and she's the one that ensures that folks are trained to do that. Now, at the local level, Child Protective Service workers would be working through law enforcement, and that's who would be accessing that until we get another procedure in place.
So currently you go through your local police department to get access to the records. Is that how it occurs?
Chair Dalto and Speaker Minnis, the way that it occurs is that we have an interagency agreement with the LEDS administration that allows an entity to access, as a subject agency, that criminal records information, and they meet the requirements, training requirements, to do that. It isn't necessarily an arrangement with a particular local law enforcement agency.
How do you currently feel that the communication between law enforcement and the department, do you feel like there's a free flow of information, or what is your impression?
Chair Dalto, Speaker Minnis, I believe that we have an excellent working relationship with law enforcement, but there are limits to the amount of information that they can share with us, given the restrictions within the LEDS requirements.
This is an interesting hearing. I was visited last week by our local sheriff in Multnomah County, who went through his legislative agenda, but at the end, what he talked about was the concern over the experience he had working with the department with a young girl that was killed in the park there in Gresham about 4 years ago. And he expressed the concern that one of the frustrations, he said, was they had an inability as a department to get information from DHS or Children's Services Division to do an investigation. And he felt like that is still, felt like we had not made progress on that front, and still expressed concern that law enforcement doesn't have an ability, because basically it was his impression that the department closes ranks and they can't get in there to get accurate information, even in the death of a child. And that is an ongoing concern, and he was pretty direct and felt passionate about it, and I'm going to ask him to come down and testify to that. I think it would be good for this panel to hear from the law enforcement side the difficulty they have getting information from your agency in regard to some of these cases.
Chair Dalto and Senator Minnis, and we would welcome those comments in terms of how that has worked in Multnomah County. I do know that historically that has been an issue, and I do recall the case you're talking about. I think one of the things we've tried to do with this critical incident response team, we had law enforcement on the committee to help build this team, and in the two cases that we actually have put into this process, law enforcement actually has taken the lead on both of those cases because of pending criminal charges, and law enforcement basically has worked very closely with us. These both happen to be Clackamas law enforcement, but they have been able to give us the word as to when it's okay for us to move in and do certain interviews with our own staff. They've been able to share with us information that we would not have presented publicly until they said it's okay to share this information. And by having our Attorney General serve on the CERT committee, we're able to actually give law enforcement, when they want to subpoena records, we're able to sit down and very specifically they're able to give us the list of the kinds of things they want from our records so that we actually can have that blessed by a court order. And then we are able to provide all of those files to law enforcement.
What is there a process laid out, or is this just kind of a new thing that's happened recently, or has there been a process laid out so when there is an incident like that? I mean, I know you had your search.
Yeah, Chair Dalton and Speaker Minnis, this is the new process, and we're evaluating it as we go along, but what we're learning is that piece with law enforcement works much better by having law enforcement on the team from the very beginning when we have a case like this. That may not address your overall issue, and just in terms of the cooperation of the department and law enforcement.
How does that, and one last question, Mr. Chair,
disciplinary team.
How is that working, and how does that fold into what currently is happening. But still, it seems to be a breakdown, even with that in place.
Chair Dalto and Speaker Minnis, this CERT process does not take the place of the multidisciplinary team. The multidisciplinary team already is looking at child abuse cases and especially looking at child fatalities. And that process will continue. We did not want to usurp that process because that really is an opportunity for the district attorneys as well as for the Sheriff's Department and others to meet with the Department of Human Services. So the CERT process actually is a process that we're using to try to see how we performed in a particular case. The multidisciplinary team actually is looking across the community to see the various roles in a particular case.
And even with that team in place, there still seems to be trouble getting information from the department to the police or vice versa. They can't get in and get questions answered immediately. Sometimes they'll have to wait for weeks to get information because it's the appearances. And I don't want to pick on caseworkers. I know they have a tough job, and this is a tough area of law, so I want to make that disclaimer. But there is a lot of frustration that law enforcement can't reach in and get the information initially they need to do a thorough investigation, and they feel somewhat helpless and at the mercy of the department because they can't get the information they need.
Chair Dalto and Speaker Minnis, we would love to have that conversation then with folks to see if it's something that we have created ourselves that maybe is not blessed by law. Are we creating some barrier to that communication? Because I would think that some of the information we have is just as critical to law enforcement as their information might be to us. And so that's certainly a conversation that we'd be having to engage
and
in.
Frankly, this is an issue we talked about 4 years ago.
Yes.
And we haven't made any progress on this front. So I would encourage the committee to pursue that angle. I think there's other areas we need to look at as well. But it was interesting that the sheriff came to me last week and expressed this very concern and expressed concern that no progress had been made.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Butler, then Representative Jensen, and then Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Speaker Minnis got to a portion of what I was anxious to get down to, and that is that are you in fact mining the LEDS information that's available to you as a result of criminal activity in a home? I would like to know that in part. That was one of the issues when the issue of LEDS came up. Do you actively mine the LEDS information so that you can determine if there are children in a home?
Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, if I understand your question, are you asking if there is LEDS information, are we doing everything we can under our current rule to be able to access that?
To clarification, to extract the information relative to youngsters in a home where there's criminal activity identified by the parent or guardian in that home.
Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, I would say generally we are still dependent at this point upon law enforcement, but law enforcement, because if there's any suspicion that there's criminal activity in that home, that would be a case that law enforcement would be going with Child Protective Services, or we'd be going with them out to that home. Many of the cases that we have, an increasing number, unfortunately, have that particular dynamic, and children are being removed because the parents are being arrested at the time. Law enforcement certainly access that, but the process Una's talking about will give us a little more flexibility to get that information ourselves, especially in cases when we're going out without law enforcement.
Mr. Chair, by way of example, if I may, and just using the book, The Status of Children, 2003, one of the definitions of child abuse is to be in a place where methamphetamine is being manufactured. And I hope that we're not, when all of the chemicals and drugs are present to manufacture, that we don't have to wait until there's actual manufacturing ongoing in that home. If the agents and drugs to manufacture methamphetamine are present, but I'm wondering if, and I'm fairly confident that LEDS would then identify that there are children in that home where the drugs are present and, you know, methamphetamine had been manufactured in the past, that's identifiable, but that the agents and drugs are available to manufacture, that constitutes a crime and it constitutes a hazard and child abuse in effect. So I'm wondering if we're using the LED system to access and mine other information out of there, if we've got someone in a home who's been convicted or has been arrested and is in jail for some serious crime, do we know if there are children in the home through the LEDS report, and are those children being, are their needs being addressed?
Chair Dalton, Representative Butler, I think the way we would know if there are children there usually is when the police intervene and they go out to the home either to serve a paper or they go out to the home to arrest someone. And if children are present, generally child welfare is going to be the first phone call that's made. I would say that there, I think there are still opportunities here in terms of the sharing of that information, because as we've worked with LEDS and they have some restrictions about how they can share information, I do believe we still will continue to have workers getting calls and going into homes where there may be criminal records that they're not aware of. But that's certainly one of the things behind our inspiration for trying to say what kind of access do we need in order to provide for safety of children, not just to get into people's records to see what it was that they, you know, had charges related to, but really directly related to how safe are these individuals to be caring for children.
Mr. Chair, just one final question relative to the federal Safe Families. I believe it's called.
Well, maybe we would want to give Una just a chance to also respond.
Fine. Do that.
Sure. Chair Dalton, I'm Representative Butler. Another area that we're working on right now has to do with a task force that was developed by the governor to look at methamphetamine as a crisis in Oregon. And out of that came the drug endangered child protocol that's being used in some other states. And I just wanted to let the committee know that there is a process in place now where we will develop teams to the degree that they have resources in each county in the state where drug enforcement officers will work closely with child protection staff to see that children that are in homes where there are dangerous substances and or use are protected.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Relative to the requirements under the Federal Safe Families Act, I know that there are some time limitations under the Act. Are we meeting all of our time limitations relative to children's issues?
Chair Dalton, Representative Butler, I think we're doing a good job of meeting the time frames, and I know you're probably referencing the 15 out of 22 months. If children are in foster care, the agency should be going to court with a different plan for those children. I think the real stress that this is posing is many of the families we're working with, the 15 out of 22 months may not be as reasonable as we perhaps thought when the law passed in terms of getting them into treatment, making sure that the treatment is effective and that the treatment is going to stick, in terms of them being safe to have their children returned to them at some later date. I don't think that's an issue that's unique to Oregon, but I do think it's one of the stressors that we have seen with families in complying with that 15 out of 22 months.
So, Mr. Chair, I can assume from that response that many states are having problem with the 15 out of 22 months, not just Oregon.
Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, that would be true. And recently an article came out, and I believe it came out in Philadelphia. It was a sad commentary, but it talked about the number of children who have been freed for adoption under the Adoption and Safe Families Act and who we have not been able in this country to find adoptive placements for. And it is, in fact, it hearkened back to some of the fears when that law was passed, and that is, if you free children and families are not out there available to adopt children, you in fact create something we call legal orphans. And so that is an issue with the Adoption and Safe Families Act, and I just happened to have seen that article very recently. You all might be interested in a copy of that article.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of have a series, maybe, of disjointed questions, Mr. Chair.
Feel free.
The first question I have has to do with, you said, I think, previously that when a caseworker goes out on the initial call, likely they will be going out with law enforcement. Is that?
Chair Dalto and Representative Jensen, very often, and depending on what it is that's been reported, but we do a lot of those first interviews with law enforcement.
And then I think you said that on subsequent reports, or subsequent visits. They might also have go out with law enforcement.
Chair Dalto and Representative Jensen, ordinarily, if they're going back out with law enforcement, it's because there's been another report. Something else has happened in the family. Because my point that I was stressing there is if a family is so unsafe that the child welfare caseworker can't go to visit that family without taking law enforcement, then it's very unlikely that children would be remaining in that home.
This was my concern, that that we don't have a situation where child welfare workers are afraid to go into the family without law enforcement, but we're leaving children there.
Exactly.
And I would be greatly concerned if that were...
As would I.
Yes. Were the case, and I didn't understand that completely from your comments previously. One of the, and I don't know that this is a question that we want to get into, Mr. Chair, but one of the concerns earlier in your discussion, you kind of talked about your reports of the size and volume of them, and to me this kind of comes to a QA sort of concept of having your quality assurance on your in your charts, and if we've got that kind of volume of data, I'm almost glad that you haven't been technology updated, because you know, it kind of gets into the garbage in, garbage out sort of data. And I'm curious if, you know, what you're doing, looking at your quality assurance in your reporting to ensure that when you get to the technology, that this will be efficiently used information. Is that understandable?
Yes. Chair Dalton, Representative Jensen, that is one of the things that we are going to be using the national expert to help us look at, is how do you glean from a paper file that's six volumes thick? What are the issues that, I heard this phrase in another state, the worker has to have sort of a dashboard of what are the safety issues? What are the things the worker's got to be looking for every time a worker goes into that home? And knowing that you cannot glean that from six volumes on a case file, we want to be able to use the national expertise to help us as we go to more automation. I totally agree. I don't know that there's value in automating those six volumes of that record, because, again, the worker probably never is going to have the time to read six volumes. Not all of that information is going to be critical to the safety issue right now. There are parts of that file that are critical, such as the court orders, perhaps the report to the Citizens Review Board, those kinds of reports. But we're trying to come up with something that we believe won't get overlooked because it's so voluminous, even in terms of the data or the technology. It's got to be something fairly direct. It's got to say this is a set of safety issues that have to continuously be monitored in terms of this particular family.
And one final question, if I may, Mr. Chair. I think you said 20,000 cases or something is the numbers that, and I'm curious at what the process is for purging your cases. I mean, certainly somewhere or another, the children must be leaving these environments. So do we have any of those 20,000 that are now the children that we've got in there are now grandparents, you know, somewhere down the road?
Chair Dalto and Representative Jensen, I must first say to my own staff, I did not plant that question. That is a question that's very dear to my heart, because we have a legacy in our system of keeping all of the data, all of the pieces of paper. And so if someone was known to the system years ago, their name might still be in there, whether or not there was ever any need for follow-up. Senator Ferrioli and a piece of legislation that occurred this past session did finally give permission for the agency to go in, and through a task force they have studied and will be coming back with recommendations and a rule around the purging of information. My personal belief is we probably should be a little more aggressive in terms of purging. I believe there are due process issues in any kind of child protective services system. And I am not comforted by knowing the number of citizens who might end up being in that system based on a phone call or someone making a report. And at the same time, I value safety of children, and I understand what the system is supposed to do. But I believe we have to be very deliberate in our thinking about what needs to stay in the system and what needs to be purged. And interestingly enough, that's also one of the comments made by our national expert when they came here. They were just amazed at how we keep every single thing, whether or not ultimately it's meaningful or whether or not it actually leads to anything in the case. And they are suggesting we make some emergency rule changes in terms of how we are warehousing that information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two issues that I'd like to just touch on. I don't think we need to delve into them today, as I see we're getting kind of behind time a little bit. But the first relates to the speaker's question about information. I have the distinct impression that there's a black hole in which information cannot be accessed. When I have a constituent that has what I think is a reasonable complaint, I sign a release, or they sign a release, it's still very difficult to get any information on that case. We need to work on that. We need something that allows a reasonable outside person, and I think probably a legislator fits that description, some of the information that would help in determining are we on the right track or not. We can deal with that later. The other question relates to transitioning with police. And I fully understand, you know, when you've got a dangerous family or dangerous people surrounding this child that needs to be evaluated, we need to protect those people. But I do get a little concerned at times, and we've had several instances in Josephine County where 2-3 squad cars of police show up to transition a child out of the home or in certain situations, and that bothers me. Number one, police need to be elsewhere too. This isn't the only crime that's going on in town. Number two, can you imagine what that does to a child or to the family to have blue lights and red lights flashing everywhere with police all over the place for removing a child where the aunt is in control, there's no violence, there's no guns, there's no nothing. But it's, to me, overkill, and we need to deal with that.
Chair Dalto and Representative Anderson, I totally agree. And there is no best practice that would suggest that having police vehicles with lights going and people in uniform removing children is not traumatic to children. And that's often why the child welfare worker will go with the police, is for the very reason the police are there for the purpose of looking to see if there's criminal wrongdoing and safety of children. Our purpose is the safety of children, and the removal needs to be handled in a way that doesn't totally traumatize the children more than would leaving the children in that home.
That's the issue.
So we absolutely agree. In terms of sharing of information, I appreciate the fact that you have been able to have some constituents come forward and give permission. One of the complexities about these voluminous records we're talking about is sometimes the individual who gives permission actually can't sign for permission about someone else who's in that record. And so it feels like we're giving you only bits and pieces of the record unless other family members also agree that we can share certain information. And quite frankly, the laws around sharing information in child welfare records were never, ever intended to protect the Department of Human Services. They're actually to protect the privacy of individuals. And we would be more than willing to engage in conversation about are there ways to approach that. I mean, we have some federal laws and state laws, but it's actually for the privacy of the children and the families themselves that those laws were there, not to provide a cover-up for the Department of Human Services to do whatever it wanted to do and not be held accountable.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Boone.
Well, I have a question about the every 30-day check, and I don't know if this falls in the same as just a general welfare check on a family when someone, say, makes an anonymous report. In my district, I've heard through the, you know, I've been in the other seat
as a legislative assistant doing constituent work for 17 years. And over the process of those years, I've often heard people complain to our office that people are alerted 2 to 3 days before their visit, and so then, therefore, they have a chance to clean up their act or remove bad people from the house so that things look as good as they can. And is this a practice to give prior notice before a visit's made, either the every 30-day check or just a general welfare check on someone?
Chair Dalto and Representative Boone, it's not required that notice be given. And what we're finding is for child protective service, in-home service cases where children haven't been removed, the worker is more apt to visit without notice than the worker might in a foster care case. In a foster care case, as one of our first cases that came through CERT was, the visits were announced. And it appears that staff struggle with wanting to be respectful of foster parents and not be intrusive by just showing up. And yet, at the same time, the policy manual does allow for unannounced visits because of the very issue of making sure children are safe. We believe this is an issue that we're going to have to train to pretty zealously, because we, as we get to the place where workers are actually making the visits, the other question that it raises is, then what is the substance of that visit? What is it that workers are able to achieve or accomplish? So while it's not required, and the other thing workers tell us, they say that they're balancing so many things that they have to get done that they feel like if they don't call ahead to make sure someone's going to be there, they may drive an hour to a home to make a visit, and it might be unannounced, and no one's there anyway, and then they haven't achieved what it was they had to set out to do. But we have really got to approach it so that the whole purpose of that visit is not just the relationship building with the child, which is one of the purposes, but also ensuring the child's safety, regardless of whether it's an in-home service case or a foster care case.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me throw you a slow pitch then. I'll give you a little change of pace here. On page 10 of your report, you have the victim rates by county. And I'm intrigued that a set of seven counties traditionally have rates that are double the average for the rest of the state. Baker, Coos, Grant, Klamath, Lake, Union, and Wasco Sherman, I guess eight counties, seven lines. I wonder the extent to which you have some link to the two parts of my question. You have some link to preventive services. I'm a public healther, and I'm always interested in trying to prevent problems, and I wonder how you relate to the unit on children and family health and the public health side of human services in the first place, and try and get involved in preventing problems. And the second is, do your staff ratios relate to the data that indicate need? I mean, are these victim numbers that are persistently in counties that I think are rural and poor, which may be hard to get staff to, do they link to your ability to get folks out there to deal with the problems?
Vice Chair Jensen and Representative Greenlick, the first question in terms of prevention, many of our cases, I don't know the proportion of those cases, but you will see a connection with, for example, a community health nurse, someone who is involved from public health in terms of offering services to that family. And we work closely with the Commission on Children and Families because they actually do, they sort of manage an array of preventive services for families. Generally, by the time the family becomes known to Child Protective Services, even if it's not a substantiated case, even if it's an unfounded case, there's still a need for some kind of services. And I think that's one of the things that you see when you see the variance across the state. Many of these smaller communities may not have the same array of services in which to refer families or to access services quickly as you would find in your more urban areas. I think that's one thing that can contribute. We looked at the staffing issue about 2 years ago because we were afraid that what might happen is if you're a county that's staffed well enough, you might could go out on more calls, which in fact does happen in some counties, but you might also have a tendency to then have a higher substantiation rate. And what we've made an effort to do is sort of equalize staff. We have to continue to take into consideration that in some parts of the state, for example, if you're stationed in Lakeview and you're the Child Protective Service worker and you have a call from Christmas Valley, that you have, I believe, and I'm going by memory because I made this trip one time, I think you have about a two-hour venture to get there to see what is happening. That is a little different than if you're in southeast Portland and you have to get across the river to check on a family. So we try to factor those things in, but I think that's one of the things you see in terms of the variation here is really the lack of resources in some of those communities for being able to have something to give that family or offer that family very quickly. It doesn't mean the case won't be substantiated. It's just harder to resolve the issues even if the case is substantiated.
Thank you, Representative Greenleck. Any additional questions at this time? No. Okay. You know, I did have something I wanted to ask. And that is, you brought the dashboard analogy about the tools at the disposal of the child protective workers for the files, and I got to thinking about the dashboard in my car and the different gauges, and one of the gauges in the car is the fuel gauge, and I don't know if you can sort of roughly equate a fuel gauge to a gauge that might give you an indication of how a child is thriving in a home, or whether or not they're failing to thrive, or if they are in fact doing very well. And so it occurs to me that there are some tools that we have available to us to determine whether or not that child is succeeding. And so could you give this committee an indication of what sort of medical assessments are done and sort of ongoing determinations of the health of the child. In particular, what I'm bothered by, excuse me, I'm not feeling well today. In particular, what I'm bothered by is the low weights of these children, how it seems to be a recurring problem and a very obvious indicator. And so how do the child protective workers determine the weight of the child? Are we going in? Do we need to go in with a scale at every visit and record this information and see change over time? That's just my pedestrian idea there, but could you speak to that, please?
Chair, Doctor, with permission, I'll have Una talk briefly about how that might look in a child protective service assessment, but then I'll have Kevin talk a little bit about in ongoing cases in foster care, which, of course, the first cert was an ongoing case in foster care, what the expectation is for gauging that kind of health issue with children.
Chair Dalto, in a child protective service assessment, if the presenting concern has to do with the well-being of the child, let's say that there's a report that we have an infant that someone who has seen the child is saying that the child is not thriving, that the child appears to be underweight, or the child's not eating the adequate amount of food for a child of that age. As the CPS assessment worker goes out, of course they want to go out and make face-to-face with that family. They'd like to see the infant, but I think that what we also try to be very cognizant of is that we aren't trained health professionals. So in the context of that assessment, the next step would be to make a connection with the child's treating physician, if there is one. Of course, if there isn't a physician for the infant, then that's obviously a red flag. But we want to check with that physician to say, when is the last time you've seen this child? And we also make every effort or may assure that the child is seen by a physician based on this referral. And we get medical documentation or a medical assessment of the child. As we all know, children are different sizes and shapes, and I think that that is an area where we would rely on the medical professional to make a professional judgment of whether the child is thriving or not, and if not, why not? Are there other medical reasons that may be the cause of that, or is it something in the caregiving relationship? So that's an example.
Representative Dalto, members of the committee, again, my name is Kevin George. I work as a foster care manager at the Department of Human Services. to kind of lending where Una had left us off around the medical care for children. We are required by our rules, administrative rules, to have medical checks on children at least every 6 months. And we actually report that then to the Citizens Review Panel, which has been referenced earlier today. That's a group of lay folks that are through the courts who actually review our cases. And they actually are asking those questions, Representative Dalto, around the well-being of children and permanency options and the safety of children. So that is one of the places we do check. We also then are having children go to dental exams periodically and trying to follow up on those. So if their primary care physician is recommending then more specialized care or specialized evaluations, and those children will be referred to those entities. When we start looking at real specifically your question directly around weights and do we start carrying a scale out there to weigh children or not, it is one of the real challenging pieces around can you eyeball somebody who is 7 years old and say you've lost 2 or 3 pounds, therefore there's a concern here, or how do you actually respond to that? In many ways, it is about making sure we are all up to trained, we're all trained on knowing exactly what should the expectations of a 7-year-old, the 12-year-old, what should we be looking at? And any indications that things are not going right, then responding to that. But certainly after this first case that we had started talking about, I had folks coming up to me in the community, and one mother specifically was very concerned about her 7-year-old child who was only 32 pounds and wanted to know if there was an issue with that. And I certainly recommend that she contact her physician and really talk to them about that. But it is a challenging issue to try to eyeball someone's weight to determine is there a medical condition or not.
On the issue of weight in particular, is there a component in the training or the best practices of case management that covers weight?
There is not at this current time.
Do you think it might be appropriate to have something like that?
Absolutely, and I've asked actually my staff to start working on some of those practices right now so that every worker has your dashboard analysis or analogy of a cheat sheet or something there that actually talks about height, weight, general expectations, immunization records, all those things at their fingertips on their desk.
Do you have a resource within your department or somewhere that the state can turn to you know, have that information about what benchmarks children are supposed to hit at certain ages or certain sizes, ranges?
Yeah, certainly through public health we access that, and there is some things actually that currently are out there on our websites. But again, I guess my answer to that is more specific, getting it right into the hands of the local caseworkers and foster parents so they actually know here's what we're talking about, not refer them to somewhere to go find that information.
And the other issue you brought up was it a requirement every 6 months that a child is seen by a physician? Is that what you said?
Correct.
Okay. Would it be appropriate to have, I guess what I'm thinking is 6 months is a long period of time, and it's probably perfectly acceptable if there isn't any problem in a placement or if the child is doing fine, but you know, at an indication of a problem occurring, are you able to schedule medical care before that?
Yes, Representative Dalton. Certainly, foster parents have access to the medical care when the children are sick and when they need to, or shots updates or whatnot. And they access that through the Oregon Health Plan, so the medical cards for children in our care and custody, and going through the local primary physician for that.
Is there some kind of medical director that is involved with the Department of Human Services Child Protective Division?
No, there's not.
Do you think that might be appropriate?
Yeah, what we currently have on staff is there is actually an RN, a registered nurse, and she's actually in my unit for foster care, and she oversees a lot of the medical practices, and she trains. We have contract nurses out there, so private practitioners who actually go out and see some of these children and evaluate these children, and her role is to make sure she's training those nurses so they're out there in the communities around the state evaluating these children. She provides some consultation on a pretty regular basis with staff who call up and say, I have these issues going on with this child. Can you give me some indication? Or we received an evaluation back from this hospital. I don't quite understand it because I'm the social worker. Can you help me interpret this? And so she does that on a fairly regular basis. But again, that is one person in the central office.
Right, but that's just in your area, which is the foster care area, right?
Correct. She answers questions for folks in child welfare in general. So if children are in their biological home and there's medical concerns, the staff have access to call her for consultation. Again, one person, 20,000 cases.
Yeah, and just for the committee's information, we sort of jumped into the CERT process and, you know, these specific issues without having an overview yet of how child welfare works, which we will get to, but I think you're at a somewhat of a disadvantage until if you don't already know how that structure is, but we'll get to that. I'd like to explore that issue of, involving a higher level of scrutiny for these children, these placements with medical professionals, and we can talk about that at a later time. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kevin, did I understand you say that you also asked for dental care for children?
Representative Dalto, Representative Anderson, yes, that is correct. We also request foster parents to get dental checkups on the children in care.
And where do the funds come from that? Is that through the Oregon Health
Plan? Oregon Health Plan pays for that as well.
That's all been cut out?
For foster children, they can still access the dental care. Where the challenge is in many ways is the infrastructure out there in the communities around having enough dentists who are able to sign up for Oregon Health Plan and be available to accept that. That's where my foster parents have more of a challenge than accessing it. It's just having availability of folks that will do that.
Okay.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Y'all will excuse me if I harp a little on quality assurance issue, but I think we talked about the a critical review panel, or is that a terminology that is correct in your case?
Chair Dalto and Representative Jensen, the critical review response team is what we're calling it, the CERT. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
Or the CRB, Children's Review Board.
Yeah, okay. Children's Review Board.
Okay.
Are we doing anything with, in checking, in monitoring the quality assurance of the Citizens Review Board? And I ask this question because this may be one of the most frequent constituent complaints and concerns that I have at the... this team of experts, get together and more or less rubber stamp something that's coming in from the caseworkers on it. I'm interested in what we do, what you're doing to ensure that those boards are functioning as you intend them to function.
Chair Dalto and Representative Jensen, the Citizens Review Board actually does not operate under the Department of Human Services. They do review the cases of all children in care 6 months and longer and continue to review for as long as the child's in foster care. It's actually housed at the Department of Justice, and Nancy Miller is the director of the Citizens Review Board. It is, under federal law, every state has to have some type of third-party review, and Oregon chose to have a Citizen Review Board, as did many other states. And so it really is supposed to be a substantial review of a child's case in terms of what's happening to the child in foster care, whether or not the child can be returned home, what's the plan for the child. They do invite foster parents to that review. They also invite birth parents to that review. And overall, it's a significant opportunity to do a status check outside of the Department of Human Services in terms of how well children are doing. I would say that recently they have spoken with us and they are very interested in this whole issue around safety. And Nancy Miller and the board chairman, Bill Wagner, have said if there's anything that review board could do differently that would help ensure the safety of children, they really are very eager to work with the state to figure out how they might be able to do that.
Mr. Chairman, under question comment to you. I would hope somewhere in your agenda we may have them, the Justice Department, here to pursue this topic a little more.
if it pleases the chair.
Thank you, Representative Jensen, for that that advice. You know, we'll just take a moment to, as an aside, say that I think the purpose of this hearing today was to get in to some of these issues and have this this committee be able to draw out some questions and directions for the department. I think that we're succeeding. I think that we're seeing some areas that we're going to explore in greater depth, and this is not an issue that we can resolve in a meeting or even two or three. The department is working very hard. I mean, there's no question that they're committed and talented people at the Department of Human Services. Of course, starting with Ramona Foley, who's a national child care leader. And so we're gonna get to the bottom of where these problems are. It's going to take us a little while, but I think we have an idea of where we're headed. And so we'll finish up with this. This meeting today, we're going to have another meeting on Wednesday. I'll talk about that in a moment. But this is a time management issue. Was there anybody in the audience, a member of the public, that did want to participate in the with public testimony by a show of hands? Okay. Looks like two people. Okay. So, yeah, two people. So we'll get you to put your names in on that sheet so that we can invite you up when we have an opportunity. Just taking a look at the agenda, we pretty much have covered this critical incident response team and questions associated with that, I guess, for the past couple of hours. And I think that we will have this session wrap up in the next 20 minutes or so, 15 minutes or so, with what you can wrap up with that. And when we have you come back on Wednesday, we'll go into the structure of child protective services overall, child welfare, and then we're going to do a program with law enforcement, and we'll invite the Justice Department in as well, and we'll figure out how that agenda is going to evolve. But within the 48-hour public notice requirement. But anyway, why don't you go ahead and take the next 15 minutes to bring us to some sort of conclusion.
Okay, Chair Dalto, what I might do then is just highlight for you all some of the pressure points on the child welfare system right now. And these are pressure points that you'll hear more about, and hopefully when we come back also we'll want to share with you some of the feedback we're getting from the national expert around some of these issues. But you've read in the paper recently, and you'll see also in this report, that the department had about 42,000 reports of child abuse and neglect during 2003. The thing I want to point out, and the thing that we have to do a better job of articulating when we do the 2004 report, is because people very easily get to a conclusion that if you had 42,000 reports and you went out on approximately 21,000 of those, then half of those reports you did not go out on. The 42,000 is actually a duplicative number. And so we want to make sure that as we articulate this, we're honest in these figures and what it really reflects. So it does not represent 42,000 different children or families, and it doesn't represent 42,000 separate incidents. Some of these incidents get reported twice. In our database, actually, we can go in and see how many of these reports came in within 24 hours of each other on a particular family. Interestingly, about 30,000 families, if you unduplicate the number, about 30,000 families were the subject of those 42,000 reports. And then of the 30,000 families, about 23,000, or about 75% of those families, had only one report. And that report may or may not have been one of the reports that was assessed. And when we come back, we can talk a little more in detail about how that decision is made at the front end when a phone call comes in. Una would be able to elaborate on the choices that workers have to make on what they're going to go out on and assess and what they're not going to go out on. But I do think what it speaks to is, as we do this next report, we're going to take an opportunity to really try to explain to the public what's happening so that the public, again, knows what is a duplicate number and what's not a duplicate number. And I think we can get a better job of being able to explain exactly what that is. I've already talked about the four major problems that are facing the families, and when you look at things like alcohol and drug abuse, about 43% of the cases that we had in Child Protective Services, we know initially from just taking the case into our system, had problems with suspected alcohol and drug abuse. Another 38% had parental involvement with law enforcement, and we've spent some time this morning talking about the law enforcement piece and how critical that is in child welfare. Unemployment of the head of family is about 35%, and to that we actually have an initiative we're working on where we're trying to look at the TANF program, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, as being not just a program to get folks to work, but also as a children's program. That's an initiative we started in the winter of this past winter to really try to say, what are all of those stressors that happen to these families that may be even greater stressors than families who don't come to us in terms of unemployment being one of the issues. We know that a large percentage of the children coming into foster care, we looked over a four-year period to see where are children coming from that are being removed and placed in foster care. And the subpopulation over that four-year period, the subpopulation of families that are either on TANF or had received TANF within 1 year was a 65% increase. So it's almost as if we have to accept that you can never fix child welfare if you're only looking at the system after children get into foster care. So it's an effort to kind of back up and say, where are children coming from and what can we do differently? And so we really are trying to make some efforts to look at those children in TANF families to make sure children are safe and the family has the capacity to provide for them. And again, not at all taking away from the success Oregon has had in its TANF program in getting people into employment. But we do know that the same problems that hinder a person getting employed are often the same problems that hinder them being a safe parent. And so we want
to ask a question.
Representative Tomei.
Yes. I just want to understand what you just said, Ramona. So of the families on TANF, there was a 65% increase of what?
Chair Dalto and Representative Tomei, we looked from the year 2000 through 2003 to see how many children were coming into foster care from various places. And the percentage, the greatest percentage was not from TANF, but the greatest percentage change from 2000 to 2003 was this increase in the number of families who had been known to TANF and their children coming into foster care, which really gave us the message we've got to do something differently to help those families before their children have to come into foster care. So the TANF program, and when you think about it, you don't have a TANF case if you don't have children. And therefore, it really, we want to really see it as not just employment, but also as a children's program, because we think some work done with those families might preclude the need for those cases to become child welfare cases and thus sometimes foster care cases.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
We also know that for 2003, you probably saw in the media coverage that for the first time in 3 years, we had more children who entered foster care than exited foster care. And the 3 years prior to that, of course, I think we had a different situation in our state in terms of the economy. Unfortunately, when the economy doesn't improve, we often see that reflected. It's like the foster care or the child welfare population is a small snapshot on what happens in the larger population. We are still doing a good job of placing with relatives. That's one of the goals that we have. If children have to come into care, we want to use extended family if that's at all possible. So about 28% of the children who were placed in 2003 were placed with relatives. And the other thing, it's almost like when you have a success, you always have to look behind the success to see what does it create another issue for you. Oregon has been very successful in getting children into finalized adoptions, and much of that is the work that that you all did in the legislature with changes in law that actually predated the Adoption and Safe Families Act, the best interest legislation around children. But in 2003, we did have 800 finalized adoptions in this state. Now, the crisis that presents is that 69% of those adoptions were children who were adopted by their relatives. About 30% of the 800 were relative adoptions. That's a good thing. And then the 33% of the 800 were non-related foster parents. And the stress that starts then putting on the foster care system, of course, is that as foster parents adopt the children they've been caring for, and sometimes these are sibling groups, many of those foster parents will choose to no longer be foster parents because now they've become adoptive parents. So you kind of see where that starts taking us in terms of the need for foster parents in this state. And I think we have about 4,500 foster parents in the Department of Human Services that are certified by the department. We always need more. But that's another, just a crisis issue in terms of making sure we've got the ability to appropriately match a child who has to come into foster care with a family that can best meet that child's needs. And the fewer homes you have and the more children you have entering, the less opportunity you have to make the match that you want to try to make to best meet the child's needs. Chair Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there cultural components in that distribution? Is that different in Hispanic families or in African-American families? I was particularly interested in the Hispanic family. Are they more likely, are their families more likely to be available?
Chair Dalto and Representative Greenlick, we do try to make sure that foster families that we're recruiting, and especially relative families, that we're looking to see families that best meet the child's needs, so that if you have a Hispanic child and you have Hispanic relatives, we do have some issues related to that in terms of how quickly we can get families through the process to be certified. It goes back again to the issue of criminal records checks, and if families have moved here from Mexico, for example, it's a little more complicated to get criminal clearance, criminal history clearance. But we do know the other thing is that children of color, regardless of whether or not they are American Indian, whether or not they're Hispanic, whether or not they're African American, children of color are represented, are overrepresented in our system from the point that a Child Protective Service referral comes in to the point that decisions are made in Child Protective Services. And you will see between now and the time we come back, if you look at the ethnicity issues in this particular publication, you will see some of that represented, how it is disproportionate to the number of children of color in our state in general.
My colleague on my left has pointed out that's on page 27, Mr. Chair, in the adoption question.
And I believe, Chair Dalto and Representative Greenlett, we may have that for both foster care. We have it for adoption, and I think also for Child Protective Services. But it's very interesting to look at that and see how those numbers do not correlate with the number of children in our population in general.
Thank you. Do you have any additional testimony?
Well, Chair Dalto, I could go all day, and I think I shouldn't. I think I'm done, but we are looking forward to coming back and sharing with you all some of the feedback we're beginning to get already from our national experts and looking at our child welfare system and especially child safety, and are going to welcome the opportunity to do that. And then if you'd like more specifics about this process itself, we would be glad to accommodate that request.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Chair Dalto. I guess one thing that I have some particular sensitivity to is the rather significant numbers of children being served of Native American. I do represent at least one of the tribes that are involved here and serve on the Indian Services Commission. So it looks like that we have a rather significant five times the number of Native American in relationship to their population in Oregon that are victims of abuse or neglect, and then that the placement is for foster care is eight times with regard to our Native American subjects. So I'm anxious about that, and I'd like to visit further because I have a private interest in that relative to both the tribes that I serve in my district, as well as my interest and pleasure and enjoyment in serving with the Commission for Indian Services. I'd like to visit with your staff further on that directly.
And Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, you're right in that when you look at all population of children, the children from the tribes are the most overrepresented. While there's overrepresentation of others, they are the most overrepresented. And Mary McNivens is our point person for the Indian Child Welfare Act. and she's an excellent resource. She does work with all of the tribes, has been doing some really incredible work with them in terms of safety issues, foster care issues, and we would be delighted to bring her at some point. You could either have a private conversation or we could bring her to committee, depending on what you all would like.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure that Mary is in contact with Karen Quigley from the Commission of Indian Services, and I'll just work through that channel. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Important comments. Well, I guess I will. I'll say that I there was an editorial in the Oregonian that really this was a discussing the Jordan Knapp situation, and just a really disturbing editorial. And there was a comment in the editorial that said a team of child welfare experts that investigated the state's failure to detect Jordan's abuse and neglect found policy violations, poor record keeping, inadequate communications, and a failure to ensure proper medical care. So I would like the department to get whatever report this is referencing to, if we get that report to this committee, so that we can take a look at that and really get into those issues more in depth when you have that opportunity.
And Chair Dotto, you should have in your stack of reports there in front of you, you should have that report. It is entitled 30-day report.
Right. Okay, so that's what this is.
And that's what the newspaper is referring to, yes, and that's where you will see those policy references and where we did not do a good job in terms of that particular case in that particular report.
Okay, and I understand that you have another cert that's coming out tomorrow, is that right?
Chair Dalto, we have the second case, which was Ashton Paris, and that child's name was identified by the press. That report is with Director Weeks at this point, and he will decide probably tomorrow about the release of that particular report.
Okay, so I'd ask you to be prepared to discuss that report on Wednesday when you come back as well. Any final comments, Representative Anderson?
Please, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple areas of concern that they're not going to really relate to today's testimony, but will to the judicial and the AG's defense and all in the future, as well as just some general things that I'd like to put out on the record for you to be thinking about. One, I 100% believe that we need to protect children at all costs, and that's your main job. But there are families involved too, and I want to really discuss somehow how we do that without discriminating against parents, either adoptive or birth parents, because I've seen some cases where I really feel that there has been some discrimination. Talked to Ms. Becker, I guess she's gone now, and Director Weeks, she is here. About this, and talked extensively to our local people, but I would really like to explore this. Secondly, I have a real concern regarding court cases between the agency and the parents, where in some cases I've seen what I think is a real unfair fight. For instance, the agency puts in $50,000, whether it's county or AG's defense team. The parents are defending themselves, have no attorney, can't afford an attorney, or have lost everything in the process leading up to the court. That's unfair. Somehow, and yet they have enough assets to keep them from getting indigent defense.
Okay.
We need the equal to make it a fair fight between the two. And I think we need to talk about review of problem cases by an outside investigatory body, whether it's an individually appointed team of outsiders to come in and look at, did the agency handle this well or not? Maybe it's the CIRT. That's not critical. These are cases that are normal disputes, but there's some dispute as to whether that was a real fair decision. In terms of the courts, I have two different judges that have recused themselves from cases, very well-known judges, very good judges, but they made the comment that to the parents and in court that they couldn't make a fair decision because they had such a good opinion of not necessarily the caseworker, but the contractees who are working on this case with the department. I won't mention names, but for a judge to recuse himself and say, I can't do it because I like these people so well, I couldn't rule against them, gives me real concerns for the court case, for the court, and for the judicial system. So those are concerns that I have.
Thank you very much, Representative Anderson. Well, I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank the department for being here today. I think the department's been pretty receptive to the questions and has shown a real willingness to be open and get to the bottom of some of these issues. So I appreciate the excellent presentation and look forward to seeing you on Wednesday. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
At this point, we're going to invite the three members of the public who have signed up for public testimony. It's my intention to go about 15 minutes with this, which would mean about 5 minutes per person to testify. If you can keep it to 5 minutes, we'd greatly appreciate that, because we need a few minutes before we prepare for the floor session. So I hope the committee can bear with us. So I will invite Jennifer, is it Magee or McGee? Jennifer McGee up to offer comment. Welcome. Thank you for being here. If you could just identify yourself for the record, that'd be great. Just your name.
My name is Jennifer McGee, and I'm absolutely terrified right now.
Well, you're among friends. You know. Yeah. No need to be terrified.
I'm a foster parent, and I have appreciated hearing what's here today. We have had two kids in our care for 2 years, and our concern right now is that DHS workers have knowingly allowed these two boys to be in the care of their step-grandfather, who has founded allegations of sex abuse against their mother. Their mother was placed in foster care. And so when you talk about ditching all these records, I would note that some of these cases are generational and that information could be useful. I'd also would like to ask that the CRB, once the children leave foster care, they no longer have the Citizens Review Board to oversee that, and I think a lot of cases are rushed back to the biological parents to try and avoid that oversight. Maybe not. I also suggest to DHS that they want to look for, if they need foster parents, you need to treat the ones that you have with respect and value their input, because we love these children. And also, in my efforts to try and protect the two boys that were in our care and continue to try and protect them, we've invested a tremendous amount of time and money. We keep, as Speaker Minnis spoke about getting information, and I understand it is to protect the family or the criminal, and I appreciate that, but it shouldn't come at the expense of these children. I've also have let my concerns known to the Governor's Advocacy Office, which in turn just turns it back over to DHS. And as I was informed, if you call the Governor's Advocacy Office, you're just labeled a complainer, and it doesn't. I guess my frustration is that short of hiring a lawyer, which we've done, we have had no voice that's been able to be heard after the boys have returned home to hear our concerns. So, again, I'd like to ask the Citizens Review Board that continue at least 6 months after they return home, and that the Governor's Advocacy Office would be open. People need a place, and we have contacted our legislators, but they need a place to hear the voice where it doesn't feel like people are just covering their butts. And I'd also, if I could just give each of you just a written concern.
Sure. We can hand it to the committee assistant. Well, let me take this opportunity. Thank you very much for being here today. I'm sure I can speak for all the members of the panel that appreciate your care of these foster children that need help, and we appreciate you providing a good and loving and positive home for them. And I would encourage you if you would like. I'm not sure what's contained in your written testimony, but if you have specific concerns that you want to share with us, by all means, get it to our staff. Sandy would be happy to take it, and we could forward it on to the Department of Human Services to shed some more light on whatever it is that you might be concerned about. So I appreciate you being here today.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a brief question?
By all means. May I ask you to come back, Jennifer?
I was intrigued with your issue of multi-generational records. Was your point that it's not possible, say, to get... You said the grandfather of those children had his daughter placed in foster care over some complaint, but there's no way to tie those two things together?
Yeah, there is no... First of all, it's the step-grandfather, and apparently his rights seem to supersede the rights of the safety of these children. I cannot think of a legal or practical purpose why DHS has allowed visitations. The judge will be reviewing that, and it's up for court on Friday.
Okay.
But he has had access to these kids for 2.5 years. I was talking to a gentleman at church yesterday who's a probation officer, and he said what may be comforting is that pedophiles will not change genders. And so maybe that's... But this is his stepdaughter. So this gentleman's stepdaughter was placed into foster care as a result of founded allegations against him. She, in turn, has children, and now they are in foster care as a result of profound neglect. But we have had to hire a lawyer and just keep pounding on people to get people to hear that this man should not be supervising these children.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I appreciate you coming forward and telling your story. I have heard over the years similar cases, and people who have gotten so frustrated with being in as a foster parent, not being able to preclude, I guess, the law or policy in either returning children home to a home that where nothing's being done, they haven't attended the parenting classes, or moving into the multi-generational abuse patterns. And I appreciate people coming forward, because what I'm afraid of is in Ramona's testimony saying that sometimes we lose foster parents as they adopt. There's always going to be more of them, and I don't like hearing that people get to that point, even not just adopting, but through frustration with policies that happen. And in a case like yours, how many people are as proactive as you are?
I need to be, because I love those boys.
Yeah. That comes through. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. At this time, I'd like to invite Nancy Webb to come forward. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
You could state your name for the record. We'd appreciate it.
Certainly. My name is Nancy Webb, and I'm a previous foster parent, and now I'm a foster parent advocate in Multnomah County mostly. I also receive calls from foster parents all over the state. Usually they're regarding issues that the foster parents are having with the agency. Not communicating well with the agency putting demands on them that they don't feel are appropriate. But quite often I also work on allegation issues. And my finding is that that's where we lose most of our foster parents. When an allegation comes, the process in nature is very hurtful. And by the time it's over, many, many foster parents have reached the point where they can no longer continue to work with the agency. But actually, I'm here today because I want to speak in the interest of all foster parents in this state and help you to realize that Ramona was talking about huge numbers of children. in fact, the foster parents who are usually are the ones that get allegations, they're less than 2% of that total number of problem situations that she's talking about. So foster parents are not the big main picture around child abuse, but because the issues that have come up recently that were such high-profile issues and involved foster parents, it's very hurtful to those of us who not only advocate for foster parents but do foster care. And it's very hard for us to be out in public, quite frankly, to speak to other people and encourage other people to do foster care when these situations arise. So I think it's really important that the media and yourselves need to understand that this is just a very minute population. And yes, foster care does lend itself to child abuse in some situations. But I also want to say that there's some really good reasons for that. The kind of children that we have that come into foster care today are so much worse than the children that we had 10, 15, or 20 years ago. A while ago, you might get the next door neighbor's child because mom maybe got sick and had to go in the hospital, or, you know, dad took off to find a job and left mom without any support, and the kids came into care. Today, these kids are medically fragile infants, drug-affected children, teenagers with criminal histories. They're very, very difficult. Add in some reactive attachment disorder, some ADHD, and some other things that these children have, and we have real problem children in our homes. And I recognize that the state budget is very tentative at this point, but I'm here because the 20% that we're talking about decreasing for DHS will affect foster parents. And quite frankly, the foster parents that are doing medical care and doing good care for really, really needy children cannot afford a cut in their pay. They've had several cuts already. They've been promised that those were temporary. Guess what? They haven't come back, and they're talking about more cuts. Many of those foster parents who do medical care are RNs. They are professional medical people, and they're doing a good job. But they can't continue to do this kind of work with these kind of children and suffer continuous cuts in their reimbursement for their services. One of the things that I want to say on behalf of the agency is that caseworkers are just as overworked as foster parents. We have too many children in our home. They have too many caseloads to carry. There's not enough people to do the work that's there. The face-to-face visits are supposed to happen every 30 days. Guess what? Some of them do and some of them don't. And I can give you names if you need them. But the fact is, they don't always happen. The last one that was such a high-profile case in Clackamas County, that was an adoptive placement. By the time these cases get to the point where a foster family is ready to adopt them, the caseworkers are moving on to other cases. They don't have time, energy, space to make those 30-day appointments and keep them all the time. I do want to say that unannounced visits is very insulting, I'll just say it that way, for foster parents. We are perhaps considered volunteers, but we feel like we're professional child care providers, and we feel like we deserve the courtesy of a phone call at least to say, hey, we're in the neighborhood, can we drop by and see their child? That's all we need. We don't need 3 days' notice. We don't need 2 weeks' notice. We just need the courtesy of somebody saying, I'm here, could I stop by? Because most of those people are not trying to hide what they've done to the children. Another consideration is, again, the level of need of the kids that are in foster care. Those children are failure to thrive. They've been exposed to meth, to alcohol, to poly drug use by their parents. And they are extremely needy children. And yes, they should be seeing regularly a doctor, and I hope that all of them are. And the CRB helps us keep accountable with that. And I think that's very appropriate. But for a caseworker who only sees the child once every 30 days, I'm going to say it's really hard for them to make a choice on whether or not the home is appropriate, with a short visit. I do believe DHS is making huge changes and huge progress, especially in Multnomah County, in working with foster parents, because that's what I do there, and they have opened up their doors. They do let us come in and mentor. But I want to urge you to consider that transitioning kids appropriately is just the highest priority there is. As the previous speaker and earlier you spoke about police cars pulling up at the door and children being ripped out of their home, that kind of thing has to stop. That has to stop for foster care placements that are being changed also. Allegations are the number one cause that I see for foster parents failing to continue doing foster care. And I really would like to see DHS own some responsibility in the problems that are created. When I go into an office and a foster parent says to me, I've been calling the caseworker for 3 days and they haven't called me back, I know that caseworker's swamped. They know that caseworker is swamped. But somewhere along the line, decisions got made and decisions continue to be made that there's no going back on, and the agency chooses not to go back and say, oh my gosh, you know what, we did make a mistake, we will help you correct it. That's the one thing I ask for right now, is an opportunity for DHS to own mistakes, say it's our fault, we didn't show up on that 30-day visit, and because of that, this child may have some needs that aren't being addressed, instead of blaming that always on the foster parent.
Okay. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Your comments, Nancy. I think there's a question. Representative Tomei?
It's more of a comment. Thank you so much for speaking up for the 99% of the foster parents who are wonderful and do such a terrific job. Many of these are saints working with extremely difficult children under extremely difficult circumstances.
Thank you.
So as a former foster parent and as a former CSC worker who worked with foster parents, I really appreciate you coming, speaking in support of the foster parents and also the caseworkers. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Committee will stand at ease for just a moment. Tina, you're on the list here. Can we invite you to come back on Wednesday and lead off? Would that be okay? All right. Okay, well, we're not going to stand at ease. I guess we have that resolved. So I want to thank the committee for working with us this whole time this morning, and we're going to continue with this issue. And if there's any additional comments communication from the public on this issue, we welcome you to bring it forward to staff. And with that, our meeting is adjourned.